flying into Shannon Airport on the west coast of Ireland. As I'm flying in, I'm thinking of a journey I took several years ago. As I was leaving American airspace, going across the Atlantic, I was suddenly aware I was able to listen to cockpit radio. So I heard all the sound of air traffic control out of America, out of the East Coast. And then suddenly, it was extraordinary white noise. I felt like I was on my own, like Amelia Earhart, like a solo pilot crossing the Atlantic. It's really unexpected, quite emotional. I get welled up now, even thinking about it.
We came across the Atlantic in 16 hours. We had no radio to guide us. We had fog nearly all the way across. I saw the sky once for long enough to fix our position by the stars. We sat in an open cockpit with the sleet driving against and obscuring the windscreen. Then ice began to form all over the wings and clogged the aileron hinges, causing the plane to get into a dangerous spin. She spun through the clouds and came out just above the waves. It was an unpleasant moment until Alcott got us out of the spin. After that, we went on and on.
And then suddenly, out of nowhere, seemingly, came this voice, and it was Shannon Air Traffic Control, welcoming the pilot in.
Turkish 34, good morning. Welcome to Sandwich. Go ahead, sir.
And I felt like I was being welcomed in as well.
Good morning, Jim. Approaching 30 West, flight number 330, CBLC7.
We went on and on, until at last we saw the green fields of Ireland.
Ladies and gentlemen, we've just commenced our initial approach now for Shannon Airport. We'll be landing there within the next 10 minutes.
That Sunday morning that Brown and Alcott landed, it was in June 1919, I was going towards Clifton across the moor with cattle, and I noticed a plane coming in from the Atlantic. The noise was terrific in those days.
The sound is so strange, entirely new to this isolated part. Then I see it coming in towards me over the sea. I know who it is, for yesterday I heard the news that they'd left. Now he comes right overhead.
It flew around Marconi's old wireless station that used to be there at the time. They came along by the lake and they fancied they seen a level patch of moor and they made a landfall.
I think he must think it's a green field over there. Actually, it's a bog.
And she nosedived.
And then we crashed in the bog.
My dog was there ahead of me, barking at them and wagging his tail. And I said to them, "Welcome, boys. Where to and where from?" They said, "From Gander. Where are we? Are we in England?" "No," I said, "you aren't. You're in the west of Ireland, near Slinehead." I said, "You're two great men," and I shook hands and congratulated them for conquering the Atlantic.
And as I ran to the wrecked plane and the two men staggered out, the first words of Sir Arthur Whitton Brown were,
"Well, that's the start. I suppose they'll soon be coming over in dozens."
Now, on our final approach into Shannon Airport now, ladies and gentlemen, one final check that your seatbelt securely fastened. Tape it up in front of you, slipped up, your seatbelt.
How right he was. Arthur Whitton Brown, with John Alcock, made the first transatlantic air crossing nearly 100 years ago, taking off from Gander in Newfoundland in their World War I Vickers Vimy. They crash-landed in a bog in Galway in the west of Ireland 16 hours later. That was just the start of Ireland's crucial part in the history of transatlantic flight. It's the first landfall heading east over the 3,000-mile stretch of water. Within 20 years of Alcock and Brown's pioneering flight, the first regular transatlantic air service was launched in July 1937 using flying boats. Foynes, on the Limerick side of the Shannon estuary, with its sheltered harbour and long stretch of calm water, was ideal for them to land, and President de Valera himself was there to greet the inaugural flight.
"I'm very glad to be able to welcome here Captain Gray on this first trial trip. Everything has been most successful. It's wonderful to see America and Ireland so near now, just only 12 hours apart."
"And ladies and gentlemen, you're all very welcome to Shannon. Local time coming up to 20 past 12 in the afternoon. Gurmila Mahag of Akarjan, free house, Jalurlingas and you. Tasulagi Gomajet Hanifas Nejant. Slán agus bánat leith galair. Thank you, good afternoon, and a safe homeward journey to you all."
My onward journey was just 20 minutes down the road to Ballygreen and the North Atlantic Communications Centre, where I was hoping to put a face to the voice that had welcomed the pilot and me on that transatlantic crossing when my in-flight entertainment had been switched to cockpit radio.
Hello, I'm Joe Ryan. I'm the operations manager for the Irish Aviation Authority, North Atlantic Communications, at Ballygreen.
Each one of those markers is a plane.
We're looking at the screen just to show you the Irish airspace, which is an area of 450,000 square kilometres, approximately five times the size of Ireland.
Ballygreen is linked with Prestwick Air Traffic Control in Scotland. Together they coordinate what's known as the Shanwick Oceanic Control Area.
The Shanwick Oceanic Control Area, which is our primary area of responsibility, extends from the coast of France, Ireland and Scotland, out as far as mid-Atlantic, which is at 30 West. Our boundary area to the south of us is just north of the Azores, and our northern boundary is just south of Iceland. It's an area of approximately 3 million square kilometres, about 35 times the area of Ireland. We are the world's busiest aeronautical communications radio service. During 2013, we handled just over 400,000 flights, and this makes up 90% of all flights between Europe and North America.
Right. So back to that night when I heard the voice of Shannon, I presume, an Irish voice certainly coming out of the dark. Whereabouts would that have been? Where would my aircraft have been crossing?
That would be approximately mid-Atlantic at 30 West, eastbound. It's a pity we didn't know what particular time it was. We could tell you what date it was. We could pretty much tell you exactly where it was. But we can safely assume it was in the vicinity of 30 West, which would be mid-Atlantic.
Navigator calling pilot. We've crossed it.
Crossed what, Bill?
The line of no return, sir.
I'll have a coffee on that. Pass up that thermos.
The line of no return.
What is it, Mr. Howard?
It's a line down the middle of the Atlantic. Once you've crossed it, it's no good going back. Your engine may be falling to bits, but you must go on. That's why I call those airmen the men of the future.
This 1942 BBC radio programme about the wartime pilots who ferried bombers between the US and Europe was written by the poet Louis MacNeice and featured Leslie Howard.
Those ferry pirates are passing, or will have to pass, more than a line in the Atlantic. The way they live is forcing them over a line that divides the new from the old. The world, you see, has become so small. There are still 3,000 miles between my country and yours, but what are 3,000 miles to those ferry pilots? The ocean barrier is down. The other barriers will follow.
During World War II, 37,000 bomber flights were ferried across from America to Europe. And this advanced flying technology, where there was no need for flying boats.
Right, this is Eric Jolly speaking from the forward passenger cabin of one of Britain's newest and largest aircraft, the York Transport Plane. And now, Captain Brown, are we ready to take off?
Chocks away, Barnes, please.
And Captain Brown now presses down or open all the four throttles which lead to the four Merlin engines. Nearly 2,000 feet now. That's extremely quick work. And we're flying along without any bumps and hardly any vibration. In fact, the noise is very, very low.
Barnes, will you come back to economical cruising conditions now, please? These are similar to the conditions we used when we did our Atlantic crossing.
When was this?
Oh, this is about near 2 months ago now.
Were the weather conditions as good as we have today?
Generally speaking, yes. We got a little icing on one of the trips, but nothing much to speak of. Anyway, the ship took it all very well, and we crossed practically without incident.
It seems to me that this plane has a very great future.
Oh, absolutely. There's no doubt about it. It will be the thing for immediate post-war transport.
Well, she seems a world beater to me. Thank you very much. And now, I presume you're going to put her down.
I am. Everybody okay? Ready? Right.
So after World War II, it was felt there was no need for flying boats, and they had flights that could now make the crossing direct across and land at Shannon, which was their first point in Europe. I'm Michael Kerwin, watch manager in Ballygreen, and I'm here 33 years. Here I have details of all the flights we've worked every year from 1936. So we started off with four flights in 1936, In 1941, you had 2,420 flights, and the following year went up to 6,800. So they decided they needed air traffic control on the North Atlantic. And there was a station set up in Prestwick and in Shannon. So in 1966, the two stations joined together. And last year we worked 404,787.
Good heavens. I'm interested in finding out more about the voices behind the air traffic control and the voices that the pilots hear.
Well, between 1936 and 1949, communication was by Morse code. So you needed a radio officer on the flight and also a radio officer at Ballygreen radio station. But from 1949 onwards, it changed to voice.
Sam 8084, Shannon Radio. I copied 45 north, 15 west at 1227, flight level 35.
We've had a few romances in Ballygreen where we had communication assistance up until the mid-1960s, and many of the ladies in that job married many radio officers here. My father was one of the first radio officers to come here in 1936, and he lived in Newmarket-on-Fergus, which is 2 miles away. And they were staying in a small hotel, and he met my mother in the hotel, where the ladies in Newmarket were very pleased to see a lot of new workers in the area, and back in 1936. So it was a great boost to the economy to see the station being built here.
And once the flying boats were superseded after World War II, there was another boost to the local economy. The focus shifted from Foynes to the other side of the Shannon Estuary in County Clare. Niall Maloney is Head of Operations and Services at Shannon Airport.
The Irish government in the mid-1930s set up a group to investigate where best to site an airport. Charles Lindbergh, the US aviator, was involved in that group. They visited a number of sites throughout the country. And in the end, Rhinanna, which is the forerunner for Shannon Airport, was born. The first flight in Shannon Airport happened in 1939, and the first commercial flight happened in 1942, with the first transatlantic flight then being in 1944.
And there she goes. As she passed us, she was airborne. She's now 50, 60 feet up in the air and still climbing, going away to the westward from us, the white tail light steadily vanishing into the evening sky.
Shannon was probably one of three airports that are designated as being a fuel stop for aircraft, because aircraft didn't have the technology to travel across the transatlantic without a stop. So I suppose, being the most westerly point of Europe, Shannon geographically was in a perfect location for the setting up of a transit airport.
Well, the Lockheed Constellation is a very nice aeroplane to fly. It handles as well as any of the types I've flown. That's about 96 altogether. And it's very fast, faster than any civil type I've operated. The cabin seats 42 passengers. But as I've got a big weight of mail tonight, there will only be 22 passengers. Distance to New York is about 3,500 miles, and the timetable is 17 hours. We make two stops en route, first at Shannon in Ireland, and then at Gander in Newfoundland. We're leaving tonight at 10 o'clock, and we have a headwind, but we're still hoping to keep the timetable and arrive in New York just before lunch tomorrow. I'd like to say that, personally, I'm very glad to be in command of the aircraft making the first British London to New York service.
Attention, please. Shannon Airport announces the arrival of transatlantic flight number 714 from New York and Gander to Paris and Rome. Passengers disembarking at Shannon, please proceed to the customs.
This is very pleasant.
In the 1950s, a film called The Promise of Barty O'Brien, which was funded by the Marshall Plan, set up the story of a man who had a promise to come home to run the family farm when he'd rather be in America. A pivotal scene happens at Shannon Airport.
Where did you say we are, miss?
Shannon.
Is this the last stop before we reach Europe?
We'll be in Paris in about 5 hours.
Another few hours and we'll be there.
You'll be there, you mean? I'm home.
Home?
right here in the middle of the Atlantic.
What? Look, man, this is Ireland, the most wonderful country in the world.
So that's where the airport grew. But then again, late 1950s, the piston engine was replaced by the jet engine, which meant aircraft could fly longer distances. So the requirements of a mandatory fuel stop became less and less and less. And the forefathers who were here before me decided, well, you know, meet the challenge. So what the first thing they did was they extended the runway. It can take every single aircraft that is known commercially, whether it's the Antonov 225, which is the largest aircraft in the world. And we were also an alternate for the space shuttle for its first 7 minutes of flight out of Cape Canaveral. There's no doubt about it, there's been a significant relationship between Ireland and the United States.
Well, I'm delighted to be here at the Shannon Airport today as part of a celebration of some of the great people that have passed through this airport over the last 50 years, including my relatively well-known uncle, the late singer Bing Crosby, who signed this book on June 25th, 1965. And there's some nice photographs of his visit hanging on the walls here in Shannon. Very, very impressive list of famous people that have passed through the Shannon Airport over the years, including, I'm told, every single one of the U.S. presidents from John F. Kennedy forward, and of course many other great movie stars of stage and screen, Marilyn Monroe, Marlon Brando, and as much as my uncle would hate to say it, Bob Hope.
As we're here in this room, you know, we're looking at a number of historical pictures. I can't claim to have been here myself at the time, but there's one thing about a small airport. It's a very incestuous industry. My own father worked here for 32 years. He was a manager of Duty Free Shop. We were the first duty free shop in the world. But I know my father, who's still alive, has met most of the people we have on these walls, whether it's Yul Brynner, Charlie Chaplin, the famous actors and actresses of the 1950s, 1960s. And personally, he has a fantastic autograph book at home with the autographs of most of these people. I've always wanted to get my hands on it. I haven't got hands of it yet. But it really was, you know, the 1950s and the early 1960s was, I suppose, was the very posh era of aviation. This is where you had to have money to fly, and the flying was really for the rich and the famous.
And you dressed up to fly.
Oh, absolutely. And the benefit to Shannon was, you know, these people had money, they spent. And on occasions, because of the way it travels, they would spend the night in the region as well, too. So not alone did the airport benefit, but the local economy benefit in terms of the hotels.
I'll tell you, if you haven't ever seen the southwest of Ireland, next time you get a little bit of leave and you want to go someplace really beautiful where the people are really friendly and the beer is really cold, why, come back to the southwest of Ireland, to the Shannon Airport, and experience all that Ireland has to offer. I think you'll find it very welcoming. When Irish eyes are smiling.
This is the old part of Shannon Airport, the one that's recognisable from these amazing archive photographs that they have on the walls in the main airport now. This is where people used to check in and talk excitedly about their plans and their journey across the Atlantic and decide about having something to eat or having a drink. But it's just a shell now, and there are discarded desks, and sooner or later this will all be pulled down. And it's extraordinary. It has a real haunting feeling. It's the usual thing of if only walls could talk, because the Limburg Room was, in fact, the restaurant that people came from miles to eat at, even if they weren't travelling anywhere, because it was so glamorous. And, of course, reflects the name of the person who flew across the Atlantic. Looking out now at the courtyard, and it's almost like an archaeological site. There are plants growing up through the cracks and faded paint and some birds nesting, but also coloured light bulbs all the way around, which really make you think of what it must have been like when all those were on in the evening and people came to go to the restaurant here. Even when they went flying, it was such a famous place, the Limburg Room. And they would have their furs and their fancy clothes and just really get into the glamour of flying the Atlantic.
Come fly with me, let's fly away.
If you... Liz Mangan from Aer Lingus In-Flight Services.
How many times do you think you've crossed the Atlantic yourself?
I'd imagine it's over 1,000 trips.
Astonishing.
And every day is different. And I still love putting on my uniform and coming to work. You never know who you're going to meet on a flight. And every passenger has a story. And you have time to engage your passengers and talk to them on the flight, because the transatlantic flights, the average flight is about 7 hours.
But crossing the Atlantic is something very special, isn't it?
It's magical, really. It's a link from our small island to the United States, and the history that's there. In the 1950s, the Americans, they invested a lot in the local area here, the Shannon Free Zone. But before that, the flying boats with Pan Am, they used to stop off in Foynes, which was the precursor here to Shannon International Airport. You know, sometimes the weather might have been a little bit inclement, and the head chef, Joe Sheridan, one evening, he received news that the flying boat from Pan Am was returning to Foynes Airport with some cold and tired passengers. So he brewed a hot pot of coffee, and he added some Irish whiskey and some cream on top and a little bit of brown sugar, and hence Irish coffee was invented. So that's his legacy.
Indeed, we're waiting for the Irish coffee to be made.
Yes.
Irish coffee was a big thing. Irish coffee was a big thing here in the airport.
Michael Fitzgerald was the barman in the Sheridan Bar for 35 years.
We had Fidel Castro here on several occasions, and one day we allowed him to come in behind the bar and make his own Irish coffee. Ah, he spilled a bit of cream and things, but held up his presentation. They all clapped and the whole lot. And I said, well, if you don't clap, I said, they might be in trouble when they go home. But that was gone back. I think he was going to Russia. It was either Brezhnev's or Andropov's funeral he was going to. And he stopped back on the way home again and had more Irish coffee. He always loved the Irish coffee. George Bush Sr. and myself, we had him in the VIP room, showed him how to make Irish coffee. We had several photographs taken. I still have them at home. They sent them on to me. I still have them at home, in fact. But
I think Irish coffee with Fidel Castro, that takes some beating.
Oh, yeah.
There's a picture here of Gene Kelly, isn't it?
Yeah, Gene Kelly.
With a produce stand selling milk and other things that you wouldn't normally find in a shop at an airport now.
In the 1950s, there was a market for it. People did take food on board the aircraft. It was part of, you know, the sales and marketing pitch that we had here. Yeah. So it wasn't just the cigarettes, the bottle of booze, but also was fresh produce. Duty-free, Shannon commenced the first duty-free shop operation in the world in 1947. And in the 1980s, we actually went into the consultancy business. We opened the first duty-free shop in Moscow, Leningrad. We were involved in Pakistan, Dubai, and many, many airports throughout the world, Canada, United States. So we have sold the duty-free idea around the world. We should have patented it. That's what we should have done.
Weekends on the BBC World Service.
The BBC's Razia Iqbal has been talking to some of the world's most influential architects and designers.
You must immerse yourself in the purpose of a building, and if you fulfill that, you will create something of great beauty.
In the final programme, it's Israeli architect and urban planner Moshe Safdie. He talks about his commitment to public projects.
It's always about how it's going to be used and what impact it's going to have on the community. It's an underlying responsibility.
And answers questions from an audience.
The main Yad Vashem building, at the end, when you come up into the light, did you think of that from the beginning?
I thought going to the mountain and emerging on the other side of the mountain, and then you come back to light, to a reaffirmation of life.
Dream Builders with Moshe Safdie. Online at bbcworldservice.com.
I'm Christine Finn. After the news, I'll be resuming my Atlantic crossing. A voice welcoming me to Irish airspace began this journey. In future, that welcome may come via SMS, text message.
I think it'll still be quite a while before texting or data link communications replaces the directing of airplanes to airports. But a lot of that over time will happen with GPS routes. So there will be a decline in voice communications over time.
BBC News, I'm John Shea. European Union foreign ministers are due to hold a second day of discussions in the Italian city of Milan about the crisis in Ukraine. The German foreign minister said the crisis needed to be contained to avoid direct military confrontation between Ukraine and Russia. A member of the Russian parliament has said that NATO's offer to consider any membership application by Ukraine could lead to a war that would end humankind. Reports from the Southern African Kingdom of Lesotho say the military has surrounded the police headquarters and jammed radio stations and phones, mostly in the capital, Maseru. The AFP news agency quotes a government minister as saying that gunfire was heard, and he described the events as a possible coup attempt. Inconclusive elections in Lesotho 2 years ago led to an unstable coalition government. China has given a strong warning against what it calls foreign meddling in Hong Kong as it prepares to announce arrangements for the territory's first direct elections. It's widely expected to limit the poll for chief executive in 2017 to a small number of pro-Beijing candidates, an option that infuriates pro-democracy campaigners. Afghan officials say at least six soldiers have been killed and many others injured in a suicide bomb attack in the eastern city of Jalalabad. A spokesman for the provincial governor said militants attacked an intelligence service office and exchanged fire with security officers. Some reports say most of the victims were foreign soldiers. Liberia has lifted a quarantine cordon in a large slum it sealed off more than a week ago to contain the spread of the Ebola virus. The authorities said they were confident about fighting the spread of the virus. And Ecuadorian officials say the world's first digital currency issued by a central bank could be launched as early as December. Central bank officials say the currency would be used alongside the US dollar. BBC News.
Shannon, Met Report. Shannon, at 1700 Zulu, wind 200 degrees 8 knots. Visibility 1 kilometer.
Shannon McGradio, Ballygreen. We are transmitting the weather information worldwide on 3 HF frequencies, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
And where do you gather the weather in from?
The information comes from the various airports. They actually send us the information.
The computer will take all the words and select them as required and make them into a proper sentence. A lady over in Vancouver called Myra Lamb, she's an Irish lady that's living over in Vancouver where we bought the equipment from. She recorded, we use about 200 words, and she recorded the words separately, and then the computer would join them together as required and read it out as a normal report.
Gander Sigmet, Victor 6, valid until 2020 Zulu. Gander Oceanic.
And the old system, we had a person from the UK by the name of John West. We had problems with the limited vocabulary that was actually available. So we went to tender and we awarded a contract to a company in Vancouver in Canada. And they came across this lady that works in a woolen shop in Vancouver.
Extraordinary story.
So we're looking very much looking forward to meeting her at some stage.
Northeast, 30 knots, no change. Reykjavik, Sigmet.
This is a picture of the aircraft room around 1960, where you had the communication assistants doing lots of the work that the computer is now doing.
Yeah, a lot of women employed.
Yes, the communication assistants were all women. This photograph here is pre-1966, which shows you the turntable system. And you have men and women, and what they're doing is messages are coming in from Gander and they're being punched out on a turntable. And then the tape has been fed into another machine. So as you can see, the computer did away with lots and lots of manual work.
I'd like to introduce you to Audrey, presently undergoing on-the-job training.
We could interrupt your training for a minute and just ask him, make sure planes are okay. What are you seeing on the screens?
It just, when you ring up the flight plan, you can get, well, when you ring up the call sign, you get the flight plan and the position report where they're going to and their cell call check. You can check a screen as well to see the map, to see all the flights on that as well.
At what point do you make contact with them? When do you talk to the pilot?
This is VHF, so they call us when they're approaching 15 West.
8191 calling Shenlink 66.
Lufthansa Cargo 8191, Shenlink Radio. Good afternoon, sir. Go ahead, please.
Yes, we have CPDLC. And
that's when they call us, and then we transfer them to HF around the room.
Do you speak to them yourself?
Yeah, I do, yeah.
What do you say?
Well, when they call, they usually just tell them to go ahead and they give you a position report and then you'll tell them to contact a HF frequency for a cell call check and then they'll call one of the other positions around the room.
Record check is okay. Second area is 8879 and later on press 135260 and we are maintaining 81. Can we requesting level 0.82?
Lufthansa Cargo 8191 Sandwich. I've copied your request, sir. Stand by, I'll call you back.
So will you be the first voice that they're in contact with for a few hours, do you say?
Well, no, they're after being handed over from like Shannon and Dublin. They've been handed over from high level in Shannon to us, and then we go out to the next.
Right. So you're sending them off into the Atlantic?
Yeah, out to the North Atlantic, yeah.
On a typical day, the flow of traffic has two distinct flows. During the daytime, it goes from east to west. During the nighttime, it's west to east. We're just looking here. It's towards the late afternoon, where the westbound flow of aircraft is getting quiet. The bunching of the aircraft now is in the Gander Ocean area in the region of 40 West.
It's just occurred to me, I actually have a friend on a flight to Vancouver at the moment, who'd be one of those dots.
What flight is it, do you know?
It's an Air Canada flight.
855.
Okay, Air Canada flight out of Heathrow.
Yeah, it's 855. I've used it several times myself. Here we are.
Just bring up the Iraqi report there, Joe.
Yeah, it's like, here he is.
See, the checkpoint is coming from Scottish into the Shanwick Oceanic Control Area.
Well, I never thought I'd be looking at a flight that I knew someone on.
Did you say that you are now CPLC and it just didn't log on in time, or are you negative CPLC now?
To be honest, I didn't log on in time.
That's not a problem. I've copied the report. It should be okay. Thanks.
Jimmy O'Loughlin. Jimmy is...
Hello, Christine.
Nice to meet you.
Hello.
In charge of cohorts here today. Most of the traffic has gone by now, and... it's getting quieter down now for the rest of the evening.
As you wouldn't be expecting to do too much more unless there's an emergency?
Right now, unless there's an emergency, I wouldn't be expected to do a whole lot. But in about half an hour to 45 minutes time, we're going to start planning for the evening's traffic. And the radio conditions changing between night and day, we'll have to change the frequencies we use. So I'll need to give all the stations we work with around the Atlantic advance notice so that they can advise flights, for instance, coming from America. They'll need a certain amount of notice of our frequency changing. So in about half an hour's time, I'll be looking to do that and sending that information around to all our colleagues around the ocean.
Very special place, the Atlantic, isn't it?
It is indeed, yeah. Yeah, it's an interesting place, you know. A lot goes on that people don't realise. You know, aircraft divert regularly enough for all kinds of reasons. You know, they might have equipment failure on board, or as we've had a recent case lately, there could be an unruly passenger, for example. Now, sometimes that makes the news, but very often it doesn't. Sick passengers very often require an aircraft to divert. Things out of the ordinary like that make it exciting for us. That's never heard of. When I go home, nobody's ever asking me what happened last night. So stuff like that makes it very interesting.
1279er. Shanwick.
Gander on 8831, back up 112790. Kilo Alpha Yankee 52.
Kilo Alpha Yankee 52, Shannon. Good read back, thanks.
I think the day I remember most in Ballygreen was the 11th of September 2001, when the planes crashed into the Twin Towers. I was on evening duty that day, and at about 10 to 3 leaving home, I just heard on the radio about what happened. And I came into Ballygreen at about 3:45, and it was really, really busy with flights being instructed to turn back. And there was a set procedure involved, and everything went so smoothly, it was amazing. Where all flights crossing had been instructed to turn back against traffic coming against them. But as there's a set procedure, it was just seamless, error-free. There was an eerie feeling around 8 o'clock in the evening to see, with the maps we have in the North Atlantic, to see them just blank, with no flight up in the sky.
That's a unique situation.
It was a unique situation, yes.
You are trusting that this person on the ground will vector you through what is now a very busy piece of sky. And you have to have trust in the fact that he'll do it correctly.
Ian McGregor is a British Airways pilot who captained his first transatlantic flight in 1999, 40 years after his father.
My father was sitting in a plane with a sextant trying to get shots on stars to navigate by. And nowadays we have three global positioning systems which will pick up and pinpoint our position down to within 6 feet. My father was a BOAC captain on Hermes, and my mother was a stewardess, back in 1954. I think quite a few of the pilots at that point had come through a war, and they'd used humour to get themselves through the war. So there was quite a lot of practical joking that went on, and they used to have a star sight in the flight deck, almost like a periscope that came out of the top of the aircraft. And you would put your eyes up to it, rather like binoculars or a telescope, and they would put the graphite off pencils round the star sight, and then they would get the stewardesses to look up at the stars. And obviously when they then went back into the cabin, they would have two big black eyes with all the graphite around their eyes.
You meet some very interesting people on flights, and they might like a nice Irish cup of tea at 4 o'clock in the morning traveling in from America. You know, that's still only 11 o'clock in the US, and it's a quiet time. And there's something very special about traveling through the night, and you're up so high near the stars, and, you know, it's amazing. There's a silence at 4 a.m. and you make them a cup of tea and they'll just open up and they'll tell you some interesting stories about their lives and how they ended up maybe in their careers, and it's fascinating.
Sometimes flying across the Atlantic, I'll look at these stars, you get these fantastic night skies, and I'll think, gosh, how did people navigate by these? You know, it's just, it fills me with great respect for these people who just flew across navigating by the stars only.
I was flying a BOAC Stratocruiser from New York to London on the Monarch flight. When approaching Goose Bay, Labrador, I noticed away out to the left of the aeroplane a number of dark objects suspended in the sky, silhouetted against the evening sky.
What exactly did they look like?
Well, there were about six small objects which were little more than dots, and one very much larger than the rest. Perhaps 40 or 50 times larger than the dot. But this had no definite shape, but rather kept changing its shape from one moment to the next. At one moment it looked something like a dart or broad arrow, and then began to merge into a different shape and looked something like a dumbbell, and then again changed once more into something that almost resembled a telephone receiver. But at all times it was solid and black, a silhouette.
Would it appear to have been a sort of small plane escort for a larger flying object?
In a sense, they behaved as aircraft would, but the size of the large one relative to the small ones was very much larger than any bomber is in relation to a fighter. It was more like the relationship in size between, say, the Queen Mary and a number of tugs getting it out of harbour, that difference in size. As I was watching them, they began to fade. The smaller ones I lost track of completely, and the larger one began to get smaller. And then after 2 or 3 minutes, it was no more than a speck, and then disappeared.
It just seemed to stop in midair and then just disappear, fade away from us in about, maybe 30 seconds or so.
What's your own opinion? What do you think the objects were? Have you formed any opinion?
Well, you can't form any opinion, I don't think, because of all we could see, or the small ones were small round dots, hard dots, like the head of a match. Mm-hmm. And the large object looked as if it was slowly turning in the air and presenting a different profile to us every time.
I would say it is the best office view in the world, because you never see the same. It's a changing view every day.
Once I get you up there, where the air is rarefied, we'll just glide starry-eyed. Once I get you up there.
My own father never left Ireland, so you can imagine the pride, you know, when his daughter starts flying with Aer Lingus. And my mum came once with me on a trip. I brought her to a Broadway show. I mean, that is a privilege, you know, for a country girl like myself.
You're from this area. When you were growing up, what did this airport mean to you?
Well, you know, you'd see Aer Lingus cabin crew arriving through arrivals, and I aspired to be like these queens in green. Pan Am, all these different airlines travelling in. You know, it's a small part of the country, but yet they put us on the map.
I started here on 21st of May 1971.
And did you always want to work at Shannon Airport?
Well, in a way I did. I worked across the river in a college, and I often looked across at the airport. You could look across at the airport, and the first 747 that ever landed in Shannon Airport, I was there the evening it landed, and we were looking at it, never thinking that I was going to spend 40 years here looking after all the people that travelled on that 747.
It is extraordinary, though, within a generation or so, how the idea of crossing the Atlantic from Ireland has been transformed from something where people would go across and probably never come back, or if they did, it would be very rare, to something where people go across to shop.
Agreed. I don't know, when I came in the airport here in, say, 1980, we used to call the departure area the Wailing Wall, you know, because you would see, you know, the people leaving the airport, and you could see they were a certain age, and you knew they weren't going to come back. You knew that they were saying goodbye to their loved ones for the last and final time. But that has changed completely now. You know, with the age of communication, Skype, telephones, mobile phones, I suppose the cost of air travel as well too. You know, now it's, I'll be back in 6 months, I'll be back in 3 months, I'll see you at Christmas, I'll see you at Easter, I'll see you the next time Munster or rugby are playing. You know, so it may be 2,500 miles away, but it's really next door, the way transport has gone and aviation has gone.
It's 6 a.m. at Shannon Airport, and I'm waiting to see the arrivals of the first transatlantic flight of the day.
How many years is it since we've seen him? Was it at your dad's funeral? 7 years?
No, it was Fergus and Jane's wedding about
five and a half years ago.
I know you're keeping an eye on the arrivals door, waiting for it to open.
Yes, I am. Yeah. It's my nephew. He's my brother Tom that died. It's his second eldest son. He lives in Toronto.
How are you?
Welcome.
Thank you.
Hello.
Nice to be home.
It always says home. Isn't that nice? Born and reared in Canada.
Yes. It does feel like home. The last time I was here, I met someone on the street, and they knew my grandfather just passed each other.
It's,
and he said,
dad,
how long are you home for? It's like, well, it's nice to hear that. It feels like home. It really does. Yeah. My dad came to Canada in 1954, met my mom, and they got married in 1959, and then I came along with my other four brothers and sisters. So last time I came through Shannon was 79. It looks a little different.
I remember the day his dad went away so well. You know, I thought my mother's heart was going to break. She cried so much. I was 1954.
You were about 19, were you?
I was 19, yeah.
As Atlantic travel has got faster and cheaper, the homecoming represents continents coming ever closer together. Today on the west coast of Ireland, it seems it's possible to be in two places at once. So I'm in Shannon Airport on the west coast of Ireland, but I'm about to step into America.
Quite uniquely, we're the first airport in Europe to have a US pre-clearance facility.
It means you can literally go from Ireland into America without actually leaving the landmass.
We have 16... US citizens working in the airport.
So what we have are the booths where people show their passports and get their identity checked and go through all the procedure that you would normally expect in America itself.
US Customs Border Protection Facility is now open for all passengers traveling with United Airlines on flight 24 to Newark.
Just passing a model of the Statue of Liberty and a framed portrait of President Barack Obama and, of course, the American flag. I'm fascinated by this area that you can walk through a door and suddenly you're in America.
Basically what happens is you clear your US immigration, customs and agricultural formalities on Irish soil, in an Irish facility, subject to Irish law, but yet once you've gone through that process, you're flying a domestic leg from Shannon to the United States.
So you don't have to leave one country to be in another, but take it one step further and you don't even have to travel to fly the Atlantic. The voices I heard on my transformatory Atlantic flight didn't just appeal to me, it seems, but to the hundreds of thousands of people who tune in to cockpit radio from the comfort of their own homes. Dave Pascoe runs the website liveatc.net. It broadcasts air traffic communications outside the UK.
That's 440 on line, you're at
The most popular routes are primarily what we call the NAT tracks, or the North Atlantic tracks. These are flight routes that are issued by Shanwick Center and Gander Center, two of the main air traffic control centers that handle the Atlantic traffic. We cover the HF, or the shortwave radio channels, that Gander and Shanwick and Santa Maria and some of the other control stations use to communicate with pilots over high frequencies, shortwave frequencies. They also use satellite a lot now, so there's VHF data link and satellite data link communication that is, you know, starting to replace that shortwave communication over time.
898, good, firm it up, continue approaches number 2.
How does not being able to broadcast United Kingdom air traffic control affect the website and its users?
The UK is one of a very small number of free countries in the world that doesn't permit this activity, and it's a real pity that we can't cover the UK. There's a very old law that dates back to the 40s that prevents UK citizens from streaming much of anything that they hear on any radio, where the radio transmissions were not specifically intended for them. So, you know, back to your question, it affects us pretty adversely because there's a lot of demand there. There's a lot of aviation enthusiasts in the UK, and they're quite avid plane spotters. And but, you know, they're not the only country that prohibits the activity. There are, like I said, a few other ones. Some notable ones are Germany, Italy, and New Zealand. But by and large, almost every other country has no issue with the activity.
There are a lot of armchair travellers who sit and log on and follow air traffic control. Does that surprise you that people are so fascinated that they will listen to live broadcast?
It doesn't surprise us. We do regularly get items called QSL cards, and these are cards from amateur radio enthusiasts throughout the world, and they would hear our transmissions and would send us postcards to verify our transmissions. So there wouldn't be a week that would go by where we don't get one of these cards, and we're delighted.
On that transatlantic flight all those years ago, it was the Irish voice coming out of the dark that was so powerful and poetic. So it was unnerving to discover that air traffic control is moving to a new system called Datalink, which is basically texting. Joe Ryan.
We must remember that radar only covers a very small portion of the Earth's surface. When people think of flying between Europe, airports in Europe, everything is covered by radar. But as the world is, you know, a big place, and there's a lot of remote areas. With this technology now, it's a constellation of 66 satellites that will be put up there, and of course will give full global coverage. So using the existing equipment on board the aircraft, you'll actually be able to use the information to provide essentially the same service as in a radar environment.
You'll have less communications going over voice. We already see that at major airports now. For example, when an airline picks up their clearance, their flight clearance, we call an IFR clearance, most of that goes over data link now, so they don't talk on that part. I think it'll still be quite a while before texting or data link communications replaces the what we call the radar vectoring, or the directing of airplanes to airports. I think that'll be quite some time, but a lot of that over time will happen with GPS routes, and autopilots are already flying airplanes, so there will be a decline in voice communications over time, but I think it's a fairly long period of time, you know, 10, 15, 20 years.
The Datalink, it removes all ambiguity, whereas occasionally there can be issues with accent or with normal voice or misinterpretation. With Datalink, you have the message.
But it seems to me it's more than clarity. It's about the poetry, almost, of welcoming a pilot in.
I have to think about that one, the poetry.
Lufthansa 4999, this is Shanwick Radio. Good morning, sir. Confirm, are you calling Shanwick or Gander Radio at this time?
Oh, we are not that far. We're calling Gander at this time on 6622, Lufthansa 499.
Roger, so you could also try Gander on 28909 or 88901. Janwick?
Lufthansa 499, okay, so we try 2899 or 8891. We call you later, thank you.
Thank you too, Janwick Radio.
What do you think will be lost in the move to texting, when you have that reassuring voice that's bringing you in?
I mean, we'll never lose completely, especially on the VHF frequencies, the frequencies that are used throughout America and around busy Europe. That will always be there. Across the Atlantic, we will have much more use of data link, so you're sending signals up to a satellite and back, but that always has to have a backup. So we always start off across the Atlantic by talking on our high frequency, our HF radio, and we'll always check in with Shannon or Gander, depending on which way you're coming. You'll always check in with them before you go to the data link service, and you always have that HF in the background. We do something called a cell call. So we'll call them and give them our special aircraft code, and then they will send a signal which sets off a chime in the flight deck, which is to say they're calling us.
This is Cactus 755, cell call please on Hotel Juliet Bravo Charlie.
Cactus 755, Shannon Radio, understand CPDLC, Hotel Juliet Bravo Charlie, your cell call.
Call received, Cactus 755.
Cactus 755, Shannon, thank you.
So we always have to do that, regardless of whether we've got a data link service or not. We always have that in the background, that if need be, we can actually talk to someone.
After all these years, it seems that air traffic control is coming full circle. This new system of data link is not so far off where it all began, Morse code. Michael Kerwin.
A typical ending to communication in Morse would be TUSU. That means thank you, see you, which sounds like this. And the other person would respond by just two dots. When my father came in 1936, all work was then done in Morse code. And I came in 1980, where it was all voice communication.
So it had gone from Morse code to voice?
It had,
and
yes.
And now it's going back in your day as well?
It's changing over again now towards the automatic reporting.
There's a question I'd like to ask to both of you, actually. In turn, what is it about the Atlantic that makes it so special? What is it about the Atlantic crossing?
As Commander Chris Hadfield said last week on radio, he said, as you cross the Atlantic, you see Ireland as the award for crossing it.
Some people may say it's a dividing of continents between Europe and North America. For me, the Atlantic brings people together.
Shenwick, good morning, KLM 256.
KLM 256, good morning, sir. Welcome to Sandwich. Go ahead, please.
KLM 256, we are CPDLC Trek Uniform.
It's very nice to know that you've always got someone you can actually talk to if something goes wrong.
So there'll always be a voice in the dark somewhere.
There's always a voice in the dark. Yes, there's always a voice in the dark.
4 for the backup, Cactus 711, have a good day.
Cactus 711, good to be back, and good day to you too. Thanks.